For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right. Well, we're going to be looking at one of the more shocking, I think, passages in the New Testament tonight from James chapter 5, where we get into the whole question of the rich and the poor. He says, "Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries which are coming upon you. Your wealth has rotted, moths have eaten your clothes. Your gold and silver are corroded. Their corrosion will testify against you and eat your flesh like fire. You have hoarded wealth in the last days. Look, the wages you failed to pay the workmen who mowed your fields are crying out against you. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. You have lived on the earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You have fattened yourselves in a day of slaughter. You have condemned and murdered innocent men who were not opposing you." Wow, what a passage. Makes you wonder, who are these people that he's so upset at? The rich, weep and howl, you rich. Are these a special class of rich people that he's speaking to who are guilty of the kind of things he's talking about? Well, probably, yes, in their setting. Generally in this culture, people who were wealthy were the Romans and those who fraternized and collaborated with the Romans. For the most part, those were the people that had the money. It was an age where poverty ruled at a level that, you know, we're completely unfamiliar with. And so there was an aspect of this that is specific to the situation. On the other hand, we also live in a world of great inequity. And everywhere throughout the Bible, the disparity between the rich and the poor is seen as a moral issue and something that cannot just be accepted as the status quo. Listen to some of the facts today about poverty in our world. About 25,000 people die every day of hunger and hunger-related causes, according to the United Nations. That's one person every 3.5 seconds. Unfortunately, it's children who die most often. The richest 2% of adult individuals own more than half of all global wealth, with the richest 1% alone accounting for 40% of global assets. Is that, wow, that's just amazing. Yet, there's plenty of food in the world for everyone. The problem is that hungry people are trapped in severe poverty. They lack the money to buy enough food to nourish themselves. Being constantly malnourished, they become weaker and often sick. This makes them increasingly less able to work, which then makes them even poorer and hungrier. This downward spiral often continues until death for them and their families. The number of people who die as a direct result of malnutrition is equivalent to dropping a Hiroshima bomb every 3 days. Good Lord. Imagine that. You know, people think back in history and think that was such an awful event to drop that bomb. We got one of those going off every 3 days in terms of the number of people dying from malnutrition in the world. Western Europe has an average, this is in response, some people say, well, you know, the world's overpopulated, so this is all inevitable. You know, and besides, it's important, people basically need to die off from hunger because there's just too many fish in the pond, and so you have a die-off, it's all a natural process. Not true, actually. Western Europe has an average population density of about 98 people per square kilometer. Africa as a whole has an average of only 18 people per square kilometer, yet Europeans are among the best-fed people in the world, and Africa suffers the highest levels of malnutrition. It's not the overcrowding and that there's just too many people for the land to support. Hunger doesn't keep the population down at all. In fact, it actually keeps it up. Africa has the world's fastest population growth rate, and yet this itself is an indication of prevailing poverty. Individual families will remain large as long as they lack the economic security that we take for granted in the North. In poor cultures, where several of your children are likely to die before they reach adulthood, and where you need grown children to support you in your old age, it's important to have big families, and they're going to continue to do that as long as poverty reigns. It's only in affluent countries that we see the birth rates start to decline because people don't feel the need to have lots of children anymore. Almost half of the world, over 3 billion people, live on less than $2.50 a day. Income, gross income. The GDP, gross domestic product, of 41 heavily indebted poor countries, 567 million people, is less than the wealth of the world's 7 richest people combined. 7 people on earth have as much money as all of those countries put together. 41 heavily indebted countries. Nearly a billion people entered the 21st century unable to read a book or to sign their names. That's a sixth of the population of Earth so uneducated that they can't read a single word. And in a world that increasingly turns on the question of technology and information, those people are not in very good shape to get out of poverty. Less than 1% of what the world spent on every year on weapons was needed to put every child into school by the year 2000, yet it didn't happen. All we would have to do would be to shave the world's military budgets by 1%, and we would have enough money to put every child on earth in school. A billion children live in poverty, 1 in 2 children in the world. 640 million live without adequate shelter. 400 million have no access to safe water. 270 million have no access to health services. 10.6 million died in 2003 before they reached the age of 5, or roughly 29,000 children per day. That website, globalissues.org, very interesting website to study. So what we have in our world today is this contrast that is horrific. You have people living in luxury and splendor and total comfort, eating, doing whatever they want to do. And then you have really the majority of the world living in incredible conditions of poverty. Even the poor in our country are nothing like the poor in the rest of the world. I've gotten the opportunity myself to travel quite a bit in the developing world because of mission work, more than most people have, I guess. And when you walk through these ramshackle slums, the cardboard shacks that these people live in, you get this really awful feeling. I'm sure part of it is just the empathy that you feel for people that are obviously suffering and in squalor and filth and disease. But there's something more that troubles you in these situations. And when you start to think about, you know, what it is that's bothering me, you start to realize that it's my conscience that's bothering me. I feel guilty because I know how I live. And just that sheer contrast is morally troubling to anybody honest enough to look at. It's hard to convey this, and I thought maybe we could get a little bit of a feel. So I put together some photographs that I've taken and some others I clipped out into a little clip here comparing the haves and the have-nots. Thank you. you, but there's something wrong with that picture. Just the sheer disparity itself. It can't be right. The Bible has a lot to say about this. Jesus said, when the Son of Man comes in His glory and all the angels with Him, He will sit on His throne in heavenly glory. All the nations will be gathered before Him, and then the King will say to those on His right, come, you who are blessed by My Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me. Then the righteous will answer Him, Lord, when did we ever see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we ever see you as a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we ever see you sick or in prison and visit you? Then the King will reply, I tell you the truth, whatever you did to the least of these, my brethren of mine, you did for me. Then He will say to those on His left, depart from me, you who are cursed, into eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you didn't invite me in. I needed clothes, and you didn't clothe me. I was sick and in prison, and you did not look after me. They will also answer, Lord, when did we ever see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or needing clothes or sick or in prison and not help you? And He will reply, I tell you the truth, whatever you did not do for the least of these, you did not do for me. There's God's perspective on it right there. In this little sermon, and it says, then they will go away into eternal punishment, but they're righteous to eternal life. These accursed people, these people who are sent away into hell, they're mainly guilty of doing nothing. It never says that they are the ones that made the poor poor, or the naked naked, or the hungry hungry. Never blames them for causing it. But the point is, they did nothing about it. They saw it right in front of them and did nothing, and that's not good enough. Well, we can be thankful that this is in that genre of teaching that Jesus gives, where salvation is by good works. And Jesus often taught principles of the law to bring home to people the fact that if you think you're good enough to get to God by your good works, maybe you better take another look at the law, because it's a little more demanding than you think it is. And later then, of course, it's revealed that Jesus' death makes it possible for us to come to God by grace, by a free gift. And so even though we may be guilty of works that are worthy of damnation, we can be forgiven for all of that and received into heaven after all. Thank God for that. Or that photo montage would probably put a lot of us in some pretty deep crap. People say, yeah, but wait a minute. We come from the most generous nation on earth, the U.S. We're giving foreign aid to all these countries. Really? Let's take a look at that. Here's the giving of developed countries, industrialized countries, as a percent of their GNP to underdeveloped countries. We're probably the high bar there, or the second, right? U.S., surely. Actually, when we reveal the legend for this graph, we find the U.S. is right over here. We're the least generous of the developed countries, as a matter of fact. Giving less than 0.2%, 0.2% to underdeveloped countries. There's nothing to feel too good about there. Even the highest levels give less than 1%. Are we guilty? You know, I made that movie a couple years back, and I was showing it to a friend of mine, asked what she thought of it. She watched it, and afterwards she said, "Whoa, that made me feel guilty." And, you know, that's really not the point. That's not the point of this teaching, to feel guilty. The point is not to feel guilty. The point is that we are guilty. Or are we? Let's think about what James says and just ask the plain questions. Are we withholding the workman's wages as he charges the evil rich in that passage? One time I was in Indonesia, and we drove past a little river that was so purple, I swear if you stuck your hand in it, it would come out dyed purple. And it was flowing out from a sizable factory there where they made designer blue jeans for export to the West. My friends that were showing me around explained that the average workmen in that factory were earning less than a dollar a day, which was considered a good wage in that country. They worked 6 days a week, and their work days were 12 hours long. They were showing up with less than $30 a month. I looked down and realized I'm wearing a pair of those jeans. Most of the products that we buy here in our acquisition thirst, in our lust to possess, are produced under conditions that are really hardly any different than slave labor. You know, if you owned a slave, you'd have to feed him, you'd have to give him a place to live. And you think you could get that done for less than a dollar a day? I wonder. And yet, we in the West are just awash in these products, and the companies doing the employing are U.S. owned. We're complicit, we're involved in withholding the workman's wage. I think so. I think it's hard to avoid that conclusion. Are we fattening our hearts in a day of slaughter, as James says? You know what that is? You know, when maybe you've traveled out in the plain states and come across one of these feed yards, the stock lots. They stink for miles away. You know, there's thousands of cattle in these things, in these little corrals. And what they're doing is they're feeding them a rich diet of wheat and sorghum to fatten them up. The cows probably sit in there thinking, you know, this is awesome. Never had food this good before. And they just put them in there for, a month or two because we like our beef, you know, nice and fat. Greasy, and we fatten them up there for the slaughter. They're getting fattened up for the slaughter. James says, you who are rich are fattening your hearts for the day of slaughter. As we live a lifestyle of self-indulgence and pleasure-seeking, our hearts being fattened just like those cows. And one of the sure signs of a fattened heart is that we have a hardened heart toward the poor. Could we look upon scenes like these, people like these, and feel so little pity that it wouldn't impact us and cause us to do anything about it? That's a fattened heart right there. Have we hoarded wealth in the last days? Well, we've done, I think, exactly that, as a matter of fact. And this really calls attention to the most questionable part of being affluent, which is accumulated wealth. Wealth, here we've lived our luxurious lifestyle, and the fact is that we still have more that we don't even spend, and so we hoard it. And that's considered the American dream. People all over the country are busy building their portfolios so they can be sure and have that huge nest egg. Typically, Well over $1 million is the advice that financial counselors give, you know, for any working person today. You've got to save up more than $1 million to be sure that you have decent retirement. That's called hoarding wealth in the last days. Have we lived on the earth in luxury and self-indulgence? Folks, if we have not done this, no one's ever done it. I mean, look around. This is exactly how we live, in luxury and self-indulgence. Well, of course, some of my pictures picked more extreme rich. It's always easier to see the points, although I was careful to include quite a few shots right from Columbus, Ohio, typical houses. You know, you guys could well feel like, look, I'm living on $25 a week, all right, because you're a student. On the other hand, we're all busily preparing for that career, and it's going to bring down the big bucks when it comes. It won't be long before that cash starts rolling in big time. It's the world in which we live. Boy, it's really something to be in some of these cities and to drive for miles through the most desperate kind of poverty, and you just realize, how could a person ever even make it out of this? No one has any money to spend. It's not like you could start a business. If you do start one, you're selling things at pennies on the dollar that it's worth. There's just no way out. And the West, the wealthy countries, are substantially complicit in this state of poverty. Here's another question we could ask ourselves. Have we given sacrificially to help the poor? The whole New Testament teaching of sacrificial love. You know, it's one thing, the rich philanthropist, that's kind of a quandary right there. We think of maybe the wealthiest guy in our town who's said to have $8 billion. He could give $1 million every couple of days, and his balance would never even go down. A lot of people give a little bit of money to something, to some charitable thing, but not enough to make the slightest difference in their lifestyle. You can't tell any difference. And I'm talking here about people in the Christian church. They live the same way everyone else does in America. They got the same homes. They drive the same SUVs. They got the same entertainment centers. Doesn't look like anything's changed. And that is sacrificial giving. We've got people in our own church making six figures. Well, they could easily live on half of that, less than half of that. People are living on less than that all around them. And yet they really feel like they're stretching, you know, to the limit, like they're really going the extra mile just to get up to like 5 or 10% giving. That's not sacrificial giving. That's petty bourgeois, self-indulgent living, and it's window dressing. It's a fig leaf to cover our nakedness. That's all it is. Ask yourself, you know, what is wrong with this picture? What are we saying here? Is there something wrong with dressing your girls in pretty little white dresses? Are we making some kind of moral objection to mom enjoying an afternoon at the piano with her daughters? Is there something wrong with this picture morally? Well, let me suggest this as a possible answer. Maybe it's a problem when these people are saying they can't afford to give 10% of their wealth to help those people. I do think that's a problem, actually. Yes, I do. The enjoyment of wealth is permitted in the Bible, but it's contingent upon the poor have been taken care of. And if the poor are right there starving to death, then the enjoyment of wealth is not okay. Not according to God. And in fact, we're called as Christians to live a simple lifestyle. And not to try to acquire and hoard wealth. That's a sin. for Christians? Think of what the Bible says. Think of John's comment in 1 John 3. He says, but whoever has the world's goods and beholds his brother in need and he closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in him? Good question. Or James's comment, which we read earlier, James 2, he says, if a brother or sister is without clothing and in need of daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warmed and be filled, and yet you do not give them what's necessary for their body, what use is that? Oh, the sentiment, the warm feeling. Oh, man, I feel so bad for you guys. Oh, this is so sad. I hope you do much better in the future. But you do nothing. You know, one of the things I love about the book of James is he's not going to settle for that. James has always argued right through his book, we have to be doers of the word of God, not hearers who forget what we just read. And we should take that to heart. Oh, hell yes, there should be an obvious, visible difference between the walking Christian and how they live. Including in an affluent country like ours, and the way the rest of the people in that affluent culture live. That should be as obvious to anybody that looks at it. Well, I might be stepping on some toes here. I probably am. Sorry about that. And I probably sound self-righteous too. But truthfully, I don't really feel self-righteous about it because actually this I feel as agonized and troubled in my conscience as anybody does. And I'm always aware that there's so much more I could probably do. I think we're all in this together, but I've been suffering with it as I've had to study for this teaching all week long, so I don't feel too sorry for you, okay? No, this situation, it's not right. Proverbs 21:13 warns, he who shuts his ear to the cry of the poor will also cry and not be heard. Oh, the Bible says an awful lot about this. Listen to Proverbs 22. Do not rob the poor because he's poor, or crush the afflicted at the gate, for the Lord will plead their case, and he will take the life of those who rob them. Oh, the poor are always so powerless. They have no say. Nobody cares what they think. And the rich are the ones with all the power. It's not enough for us to not intentionally rob the poor. We need to make certain. We need to make every effort to make sure that they're not being robbed in our name. Proverbs 28 says, he who gives to the poor will never want, but he who shuts his eyes will have many curses. To shut our eyes, to close our ears to the cry of the poor. That's all you have to do to be one of the accursed that Jesus talked about. The cry of the poor is all around us. We have our gated communities. We don't want them coming in here. You know, we certainly don't want to get too close to that. Boy, if you let one of these people in this series of photos come into your house, you'd probably want to fumigate afterwards. Probably have lice and disease, God knows, you know. It's like you'd have to change the sheets for sure. That's, yeah. So we keep this at a distance. Of course, there's those tearjerker shows that annoy us. You can usually fast forward if you have TiVo through those, you know, the pleas. 29:7 says the righteous person is concerned for the rights of the poor. But the wicked does not understand such concern. Oh, man, why do we always have to talk about this, says the wicked man. 13:23, Proverbs, abundant food is in the fallow ground of the poor, but it is swept away by injustice. We want to talk a little bit about that tonight. Oh, that's a real true Proverbs right there. 14:21 says, he who despises his neighbor sins, but happy is he who is gracious to the poor. That is God's way. Well, this is just right through the whole Bible. The problem that we run into is it's difficult. It's one thing to agree in our hearts and just say, yeah, you know, I want to be gracious to the poor. I don't want to shut my ear to the cry of the poor. The problem is helping the poor is not as easy as a lot of people might assume. For one thing, giving money and food to the poor often makes matters worse. And there's a great fount of research showing that this is exactly what is happening in our world today. Highly mechanized farms on large acreages can produce units of food cheaper than even the poorest paid farmers in the third world. When this cheap food is sold or given to the third world, the local farm economy is destroyed. Handout programs can devastate agriculture in that country. Why pay for the farmer's grain that they're growing there when you can go get it for free? The price drops out of the bottom of the market. The food aid program represents a free government service designed to help grain trading companies expand both their current and future sales. Western grain companies. Title I sales generate the same profits for the U.S. grain companies as does any other commercial export. Title I aid is aid that's given in American grain or produce, and the government pays the bill. So to the agribusiness that's selling these vast quantities of grain, they're getting paid the same for giving aid as they do for any other sale overseas. The only difference is that the U.S. government immediately pays the bill. From the point of view of the grain corporations, then, Title I creates immediate markets by having the U.S. government finance purchases that otherwise might not have been made. The inflow of food aid, even in many emergency cases, has proved time and again to be detrimental to local farm economies. Cheap, subsidized, or free U.S. grains undercut the prices of locally produced food, driving local farmers out of business and into the cities. Some examples, like in Somalia. Remember this? Maybe you guys are not old enough to remember the Somalian famine that was the occasion of the movie Black Hawk Down. When that whole thing was going on, Somalia was starving. There were millions of people that were starving in Somalia. So the West, you know, brought food there, which makes a lot of sense. And you know, emergency aid certainly is probably the best case for handouts of grain. The thing is, most of the famine had already passed by the time grain began to arrive on the scene. The number of deaths per day had dropped down to a quarter of what it had been. And a good harvest was already being brought in by farmers in that country. When the U.S. gave credits to Somalia, which, you know, money, basically credit line, to buy grain, it had the proviso that you had to buy from U.S. companies. Many Somali farmers, unable to make a living by selling their produce, were forced to abandon their farms and join in the lines for the handouts of imported food. Instead of reducing poverty, that kind of program increases poverty. Title II food aid is different. This food is used for lunch programs as an incentive for children to stay in school or mothers at health centers receiving food when they bring their babies to be treated. While many of these activities seem at first glance to be laudable, we need to look deeper. First and foremost, this kind of food aid is still about the injection of food into the economy of recipient countries, which results in the distortion of markets. It's no longer profitable to farm a small plot when there's free or subsidized grain being dumped on the market. Just as it does with other forms of food aid, this distortion weakens the local food system, drives farmers off of the land, and ultimately creates long-term dependency on imported U.S. agricultural commodities. of the 830 million hungry people worldwide, a third of them live in India. Another case study. Yet in 1999, the Indian government had 10 million tons of surplus food grains, rice, wheat, and so on. Well, that's interesting. So they've got a third of the starving on Earth, and yet the government's sitting there with 10 million tons of surplus grain. In the year 2000, that surplus increased to almost 60 million tons. Most of it ended up left in granaries to rot. Instead of giving the surplus food to the hungry, the Indian government was hoping to export the grain to make money. And so we see structural injustice, a structural evil where power structures, governmental corruption, and greed are what is ultimately hurting the poor. We say, well, that was awful of the Indian government to do that. But check this part out. It also stopped buying grain from its own farmers, leaving them destitute. The farmers who had gone into debt to purchase expensive chemical fertilizers and pesticides on the advice of the government were now forced to burn their crops in the field. At the same time, the government of India was buying grain from Cargill and other American corporations because the aid that India receives from the World Bank stipulates the government must do so. So the U.S. will sock, you know, billions into foreign aid, but all with the stipulation that you have to use this money to buy U.S. products. This means that today, India is the largest importer of the same grain it exports. Of course, they're going to say yes if it's free grain. You know, they're being given the money by the OMF or the IMF or the World Bank. So they're going to abuse it, but they can only use it to buy U.S. grain. So when we read about U.S. subsidies and aid to poor countries, we have to remember that American lawmakers are unable to resist the urge to bring profit to our own people in the process of that aid. Canada's way ahead of us on this. They have recently passed a law that half of all of the aid dollars that they send overseas has to be used to buy grain from that country, from their own farmers, which, of course, elevates then the price of grain and betters their lives. But the U.S. doesn't do that. Haiti, which the IMF forced to open its imports of highly subsidized U.S. rice at the same time as it banned Haiti from subsidizing its own farmers. This is one of the most scandalous areas to study, our farm subsidies. The U.S. is insane with farm subsidies, $190 billion going out to farmers in the U.S. to grow things like rice. Europeans are even worse than we are. They subsidize even far more than we do. But when you get money from the IMF, there are terms, there are conditions that you have to meet, and one of them is you can't subsidize your own industries, including agriculture, and you have to open your markets. So there's a very hypocritical standard here. Of course, the reason the IMF doesn't say to the U.S., you can't subsidize your farmers, is that we're not asking for any money from them. It's only those who need their money who they have the power over to ban subsidies. Between 1980 and 1997, rice imports grew from virtually zero to 200,000 tons a year at the expense of domestically produced staples. As a result, Haitian farmers have been forced off their land to seek work in sweatshops, and people are worse off than ever. According to the IMF's own figures, 50% of Haitian children younger than 5 suffer from malnutrition, and per capita income has dropped from around $600 a year in 1980 to $369 today. Good job. We sure helped them out. Subsidized agriculture in the developed world is one of the greatest obstacles to economic growth in the developing world. And not one politician left wing, right wing will speak against it. You didn't hear a word of anybody suggesting that we cut farm subsidies in this country. The agricultural lobby here is ultimately powerful, and it just keeps going up every year. The result of subsidies is an excess production of agricultural goods. In 2002, industrial countries in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development spent a total of $300 billion on crop price supports, production payments, and other farm programs. Well, the poor countries can't do that. In many cases, they're not allowed to do it. And even if they could, where would they get that kind of money? These are very small economies. These subsidies encourage overproduction. Markets are flooded with surplus crops that are sold below the cost of production, depressing world food prices. Pretty soon, it's just you can't make a living farming in poor countries. Countries with unsubsidized goods are essentially shut out of world markets, devastating their local economies. Every dollar, yen, or euro poured into the agricultural sectors of rich nations makes developing countries' farm sectors that much less competitive. Farm subsidies cost poor countries about $50 billion a year in lost agricultural exports. By coincidence, that's about the same as the total of rich countries' aid to poor countries. So, we take back with our left hand every cent that we give with our right. I give some examples. The dumping of agricultural commodities at prices lower than the cost of production is devastating the developing countries, since most depend almost entirely on only one or a few products. Take cotton, for example. U.S. heavily subsidizes our cotton growers to keep the price of cotton down. Here are three different countries in Africa whose economies depend on producing cotton. For instance, in Burkina Faso, 85% of their population are involved in cotton farming. The price of a pound of cotton in those countries is only a third of what it takes to produce in America. But because of agricultural subsidies, by the time they get to the open market, they cannot match our price. And so they're priced out of the market. This is the dollar amount of lost revenue in 1 year, 2001 to 2003, in each of these countries. It's in millions of dollars. You might say, well, $43 million, that's nothing. Maybe here, it's nothing. Not to them. That's 12% of their GNP. Lost, because they can't match subsidized cotton from the West. Oh, there's a lot to think about here. Boy, I'll tell you what, waiting for the government to solve this problem is a real forlorn thing. The U.S. government has shown right throughout its entire history that it's motivated really by two things, dollars and cents. And that's how you get elected, and that's what people expect of their elected people, is to bring the money back home and not to be giving it away to other people and not to be using it to help those other people. It's our interest. It's the U.S.'s own interest. And this is why, doesn't matter who we put in there, I don't think this is going to change much. Hopefully it will. We should fight for that. I'm not just being cynical here and saying forget about it and not to fight for just laws and so forth. But don't hold your breath, all right? Don't hold your breath. I don't put much trust, frankly, in the world system to solve the problem of poverty. And really, God doesn't put much trust in it either. He didn't put it on them. He put it on us. His followers, we're the ones that are supposed to do this. Now, people in secular governments don't follow God. That's not why they're there. Why should they care? They don't even have the same basis that we do. We've got to take this problem on personally. And so we understand what he means in Proverbs 13 when he says, abundant food is in the fallow ground of the poor, but it is swept away by injustice. And you just saw multiple examples of that very thing right in those facts and figures. A second complicating factor is that a lot of the underlying causes for poverty are spiritual, actually. Poverty is a material and a systematic problem, but it's also a spiritual problem. People that work with the poor are well aware that in many cases, the more you give, the more booze is going to be bought, the more weapons are going to be bought. It's not going to go to upgrade life whatsoever. The more illegitimate children are going to be fathered. And what are those? You know, we think of vast armies of prostitutes and illegitimate children in poor communities. You know, that's a spiritual problem. That's a spiritual issue. Why would somebody not get pregnant? Why would somebody not live for booze or dope, heroin? For spiritual reasons. I mean, these are moral principles. So there's a need here not just to change the external material status of families, but to change the internal spiritual status of those same families. If we want lasting relief from poverty. One of the biggest reasons for poverty in Africa today is war. We simply cannot even get relief in because it's too dangerous to go into certain areas. Farmers cannot farm because there's too many people being killed. That's a moral issue, a spiritual issue. You know, dealing with things like hostility and warfare. Then too, there's the history of Western intervention, which has raised so many suspicions and cynicism in poor countries, including, in some cases, in many cases, Christian missions. At times, regrettably, the mission has seemed to be more to export European culture than it was to export the love of Jesus Christ. And, you know, frankly, not as bad as it's often portrayed. Actually, there's a lot of exaggeration on this. Desmond Tutu said of South Africa, he said something that's really not fair, but it's kind of funny. He says, when the missionaries came here, they had the Bibles and we owned the land. We bowed our heads with them in prayer, and when we opened our eyes, we had the Bibles and they had the land. Well, like I say, it's not really fair. Most of the people that seized and bought up South Africa were commercial interests that had come there, nothing to do with anything to do with missions. As a matter of fact, if you travel in these countries, you'll see for yourself the only hospitals there, the only places people can get food and care, the only schools in many of these countries are the ones put there by Christian missions. As a matter of fact, taken as a whole, the modern Christian missionary movement has been easily the greatest, most benevolent act of giving in the history of the world. There is nothing even remotely close to an example of so many millions of people giving away so much and going to live among the people to personally help them, often at the expense of their own lives and health, to do good for others. So I think it's frankly pretty nauseating when we see the guy sitting back in his couch with his little champagne glass and to pontificate about, well, you know, I just think these pristine cultures should be left on their own. We don't need to be going in there and arrogantly thinking that we are their saviors and we should just let them be. Yeah, well, that's not what Jesus said. Jesus said, I expect you to clothe and feed these people and take care of them. But what we need is a plan, and we need some sharp thinking on this whole question. The plan that we come up with, first of all, is to avoid hand-wringing and gingerbread Hand wringing is when we just sit around, oh man, this is bad. Oh boy, this is really bad. Feel real bad about this. You know, it doesn't do anyone any good. Gingerbread is a form of ministry. When you do a gingerbread ministry, you know, gingerbread houses are pretty. And you make them at Christmas, they can look kind of cool and stuff. But you really wouldn't want to live in one, right? They're not for that. And gingerbread ministries are kind of the same way. Window dressing. These are ministries where we have cheap give outs and so forth. We give our old clothes or canned goods. I remember my church collecting all these canned goods. And you'd go through the closet and think, we don't even like this stuff, and throw it in a bag. And it would, you'd have this big mountain of canned goods that was going somewhere. Nobody had sacrificed a thing. It was all gingerbread. I don't know what happened to the canned goods. I'm sure they were eaten, and that's that. Has that really changed anyone's life? Has that really relieved poverty in any way? I don't think so. It's a little bit more difficult than that. We need to understand the ethics of generosity, which is grounded in the person and work of Jesus Christ. 2 Corinthians 8, verse 9 says, you know how Jesus was being rich. Well, he was rich. Talk about the rich. He was seated at the right hand of God. He became poor so that we who were poor could become rich. That's an example of the grace and love of God. And he says we should pick up on that. We need to understand poverty. And we'd like to spend a little bit of time. We'd like to get into this question a little bit and study some of this. Because it's just not as simple as people think. It's a pretty complex problem. And then, too, I think we need to work together as Christ's body. You know, the first impulse a lot of Christians have is to just mail off some money to something and just hope it does some good. So we just scatter money out in this shoreless ocean of need, and he's going to give to that, he's going to give to that, and so on and so forth. And, you know, what happens is your money just sails out, and there's no sign that anything happened at all. Instead, how about if the body of Christ comes together, and we're in a good position here, you know, with hundreds and thousands of us in our local fellowship here, we could do something. We've got a major opportunity here. We've got the money. We are among the rich. Don't look, where are these rich people? We are the rich here by any standard. Today in the world and right throughout history, there's never been a culture as rich as we are. We've got the money. We've got the people. We could probably do something pretty big. We could probably get into some projects and efforts here that could change the lives of hundreds, even thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of people. We can't fix the whole world, but we can certainly make make our mark. And we need to come and do that. We need to come together and develop some impact on the poor. The impact needs to be spiritual. Yes, it needs to include that component. That's why I wouldn't give money to UNICEF, even if they are taking money out to poor people, because they're not taking it out in the name of Jesus Christ. One of my buddies grew up in the projects downtown here. And his, you know, destitute African-American semi-family there, broken up and lived in complete poverty and stuff, and talked about how all of these big blocks of government cheese would keep coming out. You know, they give the cheese away, farm subsidies. And how he says he got sick of that cheese because they just always had so much of that around. And he says, you know, they give us this and that. He says, and I was 18 years old, member of a gang and so forth, and I had never known that a paycheck was anything other than what you go out and pick up from the mailbox. So a complete bifurcation of the concept of work and income. And he said, you know, they could give you all these different things and stuff, but one thing they could never give you was the love of Jesus Christ. And that's what turned his life around after his third stint in prison. James Brown, a local gang leader in town, a thug, as he describes himself, found Christ. And now his life has changed. I think the spiritual component is essential in anything that we do. We need to develop impact that's long-term. These giveaway programs, giveaway programs can have a function, especially to make contact with people and in emergency situations, but for the most part, they don't do much good, and they actually create dependency and prolong and deepen poverty. What about raising the living standard of an entire community of people? What about that? You know, we want these short-term projects, and we can go to giant churches all over this country and ask them, what do you do for the poor? And they're going to name two or three gingerbread projects that they have going. None of them, they're all lacking one thing. Nobody has to go and build personal relationships with poor people. That's the one thing nobody wants to do. We don't have time for that. We're busy. And how far do we think we're going to get in seeing lasting life change if we don't actually get in with people, build relationships, and help them in the things they need to be helped with? Our impact needs to be holistic so that it's covering all aspects of life. And that's what we're called to in Scripture and these passages that we've been reading. It's not enough to just minister to one aspect of their life. We need to try to elevate people's lives right across the board. And it needs to be contextualized so that we're not just exporting a culture or trying to get people to act like we act, but that this is done in a way that's sensitive to the way conditions are in that country or in that community. We've got our own poor in this country as well. They might not be as poor as some of the people we saw tonight in the pictures, but they're genuinely poor and need help. And they have their own community. And the gospel of Jesus is supposed to be transcultural and not monocultural. And finally, the crucial point that our impact needs to foster independence. If we're doing good for people in such a way that they come to depend on us for that, we're not really helping them. We're not doing them any favors. We're teaching them exactly the wrong thing. They have to be empowered to generate wealth, health, education, and spirituality of their own. And anything less than that, boy, that is a much, oh, now we just took something and just made it 10 times harder just by saying that. That's a much more difficult project. This is going to cost. This is going to mean sacrifice. And we've got people lined up who are ready to put their entire lives on the line for this work. And the rest of us are going to have to fund them. They're going to need funding. And that's an important part of the work that we do. Next week, I want to come back to this whole subject and get down with the positive. What is our progress so far? What are our plans? We've been laying plans on this for decades now. We're in this hip deep, and we need to get even deeper, I think. And we've got specific proposals for the future, including the college ministry. We've got some ideas for us where we can start getting involved right now, even though we don't have a bunch of money to throw at it, and start to build the habit and the outlook that we need to build. That will hopefully mushroom out in the future. So I hope you decide to come and study this with us. And let's get down to it. Let's get down practical and say, what are we saying here? What do we actually think should be done? Because I get some ideas on that and think you'll be interested. Let's draw the line there for tonight.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.